Now, I want to talk today about nuclei. We talked about the cytoplasmic organelles last time, about lysosomes, about Golgi, about peroxisomes, about mitochondria, about what their function was, and about how you got proteins into them. And today what I want to talk about is nuclei. How do you get proteins into them, and what goes on inside? So we could start by saying, what does a nucleus look like? And we all know by now that a nucleus from the outside has visible pores. And the pores, so that things that go in and out of the nucleus go through those pores. And I have here a model nucleus. And these are, the pores are spread all over it. The number varies depending on the organism. I was too lazy to do the whole thing, but you get the idea that they're all over. And the reason for that, that I wanted to point that out, is that what happens now if we take a cross-section through this? Now, we all know that the nucleus has two bilayers surrounding it. So in the simplest case, this is one shell, and then there's another one inside. But because of the pores, the structure is a little more complicated. So if we made a cross-section and we didn't take the pores into account, it would look like this. Outer nuclear membrane, inner nuclear membrane. And remember, each of these is a bilayer. So that's a complete bilayer with associated proteins. But because of the pores, it actually looks quite different. It really looks more like this. Now, we've drawn something like this picture many times to illustrate that this is the outer nuclear membrane, and it is continuous with the membrane of the ER. This is the inner nuclear membrane, and it faces the actual inside or volume of the nucleus. And this would be a pore. And the one other thing we have to mention is that this is what we've called the periplasmic space. You can see is continuous with the lumen of the ER. Now, this doesn't take into account what the pore structure is. It does take into account that where there is a pore, the inner and outer membrane are fused. So they're fused here, they're fused over here, and then a protein structure is in between. Because the pore is not just a space. The pore consists of a very complicated protein structure. So it belongs in here, and it forms a pore. Now, I have brought my faithful pore model with me. As we will see, this is the one bagel model as opposed to the two bagel model. When you talk about connexons making a gap junction, you have a connexon in one cell, connexon in another cell, and they come together, and there's a hole through the middle. But here you have a single structure, and that single structure is actually located in here. Now, this is a very simple structure. A connexon is a pretty simple structure. But a nuclear pore is a very complicated structure containing many different proteins and is extremely large and complex. And we are not going go into the details of it. But if you're interested, there are very nice pictures in the book and on the web. But I want to get some sense of the topology of this because it's quite hard to get straight. How this double envelope, this envelope or double membrane forms is one thing. But to understand what it looks like, it's useful to think of it as you have two layers, and you've essentially punched a hole through the two layers. So if you think about it that way, if we made a little cross section, say of here, now I've made it clear that it's a bilayer. This would be, say, the inner membrane and the outer membrane. So what we're saying really is this is a layer, forms a curve all the way around. Another layer forms a curve all the way around. And if this is the outer one, it's curved this way around that one. But now, they're actually, and to make it a little clearer, this is really three-dimensional, so it's really like you have two big sheets. But now, what's a pore like? It's sort of as if you've punched a hole through the two sheets that goes all the way through. And it's sort of the way I think of it is it's like a doggy door. So that you have two sheets, and you punch a hole through both of them. But how are you going to keep the hole open? In order to keep the hole open and allow the membranes to fuse, you have to have something in the middle. Because as soon as the dog or the cat goes through, it reseals again. So you actually do have something in there. The membranes are fused, actually, which is why you see a picture like this. This is what you'd get if you cut a thin slice through here. You'd see the curve over here, and you'd see the curve over there. But really, what is happening is easier to see if we use a bigger one. That one was too small, so I made a bigger one. Okay, so this is what used to be one membrane leaf sheet. This is the other, and we've made a hole through it. And then the membranes have joined all the way around. But what keeps this open is the nuclear pore structure, the complicated protein. That's the bagel. So there's the bagel is in here. And that means that if we did that, so this is like the outside of the nucleus. This is the inside of the nucleus. So material has to go through here in order to get in or to get out. Now, how does this relate to those pictures you see? If you slice it through here, what you see is this. Now, there's actually a curve going away this way and a curve going that way if I sliced it in half and took off the front. But you can't usually see the curve in the back. So you just see these parts. And then the bagel is in here. Where is the bagel? The bagel's like this. But if you cut it in half, you'd see half a bagel. So you would see, and depending, you might see the back half. Now, how is this anchored? How is the bagel anchored in here? There are transmembrane proteins that connect to the proteins of the bagel. So there are proteins that go through here. So now that we see what the setup is, you have one of these pores then located, there are many of them, and material has to pass through the pore to get in or out. How does that work, especially in terms of all the transport mechanisms that we've already talked about? It turns out that for relatively small molecules, passage through the pore is passive transport. It's like going through a channel or a large pore like a gap junction or an aquaporin. Small molecules like nucleotide triphosphates needed to make DNA and RNA. Small molecules diffuse through the pore opening, through the hole in the bagel, from high concentration to low concentration. But for larger molecules, transport is active. And this is especially necessary because if you think about some of the things that move through here, things move through that are bigger than the pore. So the pore must somehow distort in order to move and act as a transporter, an active transporter, and actually help things move either in or out. So for large molecules, for macromolecules, most macromolecules, it's active. It's possible that some very small proteins move through passively. Now, what does it take for active transport in? We know more about in than out, but it's thought that they work essentially the same way. That it requires, it's active transport, so it requires energy. And in this case, it is GTP and not ATP, which is split to provide the energy. Now, if a protein is going to be transferred into the nucleus, it must have some kind of localization signal. It must have some sequence or patch of amino acids that says, take me to the nucleus. And that's just called a nuclear localization signal, or an NLS. Now, in some ways, it works like a signal peptide. How does a signal peptide say, quote unquote, take me to the ER? The signal peptide doesn't bind to the ER. The signal peptide binds to the signal peptide recognition particle, and then that binds to the docking protein or the translocon complex or the surface of the ER. So there's a little table actually in your notes that to get to the ER, you need a signal peptide. To get to the nucleus, you need a nuclear localization signal. But in each case, you need a middleman, because this sequence binds to a protein, and then the protein binds to the transporter. So in the case of the ER, it's the signal peptide, the SRP, which is not just a protein, but a complicated particle, the signal recognition particle. In the case of the NLS, there is a and this binds to the surface of the ER. To get into the nucleus, you have to bind to one of the proteins of this pore. And so there's a middleman that binds to the surface of the pore, and it binds to the protein to be moved through. And that protein, we could just call it a transporter protein. If you're interested, it turns out that you need one to go in and a different one to go out. And fortunately, they've been given names which are easily to remember. There's importin, which is the protein that helps you go in, and exportin, which is the protein that helps you go out. To leave the nucleus, instead of having a nuclear localization signal, you have to have what is called a nuclear exit signal, or an NES. So just as the SRP binds to the docking protein or a protein on the surface of the ER, the importin or exportin binds to a protein of the pore to allow transport. Now, we've already made this clear, but I just want to say it again, that transport is bidirectional. Things move from the pore out to the cytoplasm, for example, messenger RNA, and things move from the cytoplasm into the pore, such as all the proteins that actually make up the nucleus, the nucleolus, the RNA polymerase, the DNA polymerase, etc. So lots of things have to go in, and lots of things have to go out. There's a lot of traffic through pores. Now, we haven't done and are not going to do the fine points of how you link all this together and exactly what the steps are, but those are in your text if you're interested. Now, once you get all the proteins that you need in through a pore, what's actually inside? What is in here inside the nucleus? And I want to talk about a few of the prominent parts. We've already mentioned the proteins, the lamins, which are in here. These are the proteins that that are intermediate filaments of the nuclear category. All other cytoskeletal elements are in the cytoplasm. But this particular one, a kind of intermediate filament, there are actually three of them, A, B, and C, are found in the nucleus. Now, they make up a web supporting the nuclear envelope. And this is called the nuclear lamina. And that's how they got their name. Now, you've heard of the nuclear lamina, you've heard of the basal lamina. What they mean, a lamina is just a thin sheet of material, usually mostly protein, that serves some sort of structural and other support function. Usually it serves both for support and for attachment. So the nuclear lamina here helps maintain the shape of the nucleus, and it's also thought that some specific ingredients of the nucleus are attached to specific parts of it, and perhaps that helps keep the nuclear pores clear. Now, although lamins generally are thought to be stable, intermediate filaments, unlike microtubules and microfilaments, are not constantly adding monomers and constantly losing monomers. Once you sort of put one together, it stays there acting as a cable holding whatever it's supposed to hold together. But what happens if this cell goes through mitosis or meiosis? In order to do that, we have to disassemble the nuclear membrane. We have to push the pieces out of the way, and we have to do the same with the lamins. And the lamins and many other parts of the nucleus change shape. Many of them come apart, and a few of them get tighter. And it turns out that when you start mitosis, when you end interphase, which is G2, and enter M, so you make the transition to mitosis, many proteins are phosphorylated. And many of them, as with the lamins, depolymerize when they are phosphorylated. And so they come apart into smaller pieces, which can be pushed aside while mitosis takes place. And then, at the end of mitosis, usually around anaphase, meaning when you're going from mitosis and about to start G1, the process is reversed, and the proteins are dephosphorylated. The phosphate is taken off. This is another one of those cases where the addition or removal of phosphate changes the shape of a protein and changes its function. Now, the last time, one of the cases we met like this involved the sodium-potassium pump. In that case, the enzymes that were responsible were part of the pump itself. The proteins that are responsible here for adding and removing phosphate are not part of the lamins. They are separate enzymes, and they phosphorylate a whole bunch of things at once at the beginning of mitosis, and another set dephosphorylates a whole bunch at the end of mitosis. And these are, again, examples of an enzyme that phosphorylates is a kinase. And an enzyme that takes the phosphates off is a phosphatase. So this is another bunch of protein kinases and protein phosphatases. As we'll see later, many changes in cell state involve activating a kinase or activating a phosphatase. And then what happens depends on what target enzymes are available in that cell to be turned on or turned off. Now, I have a question for you. Do lamins need a nuclear localization signal? And do they need a nuclear export signal? And whatever they've got, can it be removed after they're made? So I want you to think about that for a minute. And then we'll see what the consensus is. For laments, do they need either one? And if they have one, can you, well, they must have something. Can you take it off after they get where they're going? And while we're at it, does a lament have an SP? So consider a newly made lamin hot off the ribosome. Does it need a nuclear localization signal? Well, it does. It's part of the nucleus. Does it need a nuclear export signal? It never leaves an intact nucleus. Should we take off the nuclear localization signal? Well, there's a difference of opinion. Who says yes? Who says no? Well, we're divided on this. Why should we take it off? Somebody want to?
Because it's probably a function to get through the pore, and once it's through the pore, it's not needed anymore.
So the idea is once you get through the pore, you don't need it anymore. Now, is that correct? If that cell divides, what happens? The nuclear membrane comes apart, right? So when mitosis is finished, where is that protein going to be? Well, we don't know, but it's not going to be inside the nucleus, that's for sure. It's going to be somewhere in the cell, and it's going to have to get back into the nucleus again. So because of issues with mitosis and reassembling nuclei, in fact, it's better, and they don't, it's not removed. Now, does it have a signal peptide? Where do you make proteins that are destined for the inside of the nucleus? You make them on cytoplasmic ribosomes, meaning that those proteins do not have signal peptides and do not go to the ER. So let me ask if there are questions about this before we go on and talk about the nucleolus.
How do they get past the part of the first part, the first plasma membrane of the nucleus? Does it continue with the endoplasmic nucleus?
How does what get past it?
The lamin instead of that.
Well, if the lamin is, his question is, how do you get past the first membrane? Well, remember, the pore goes through both membranes. This is one bilayer. This is really one membrane. And this is the other bilayer, the other membrane. So if something is made in the cytoplasm, if it to go through a pore means that it goes through both membranes at once.
So it doesn't need a signal.
It needs a nuclear localization signal to do that. Yeah?
Is it tight junctions around the vagal protein that separate the inner membrane lipids from the outer?
Well, I don't think that this structure here, she wants to know if this is a tight junction. I don't think it's considered that. Now, to some extent, the pore does make some kind of barrier, the pore proteins. So the proteins on these two sides are not randomized. But on the other hand, how do proteins get here at all? It's thought that they probably go around this way. So under some, the pore is probably not a rigid structure, but it does act as some kind of barrier. The alternative is that the proteins in the inner membrane are linked to the lamins or some other nuclear protein, and that's what locks them here once they get here. Okay. Now, we mentioned before about the nucleolus, and I want to talk about that some more. That's a major subcompartment of the nucleus, but as we've discussed before, it has no membrane. It's a darkly staining area, but it's got no membrane around it. So what's going on here? We actually know that the nucleolus is where ribosomal RNA is made. So that means that if we look at the DNA, some of the DNA, we think of DNA as coding for proteins, but some of it codes for ribosomal RNA and transfer RNA. So here's a section that codes for ribosomal RNA. Now, as it turns out, these genes for ribosomal RNA are usually found in the genome multiple times. So there's usually several copies of this. And they may be all together in one unit. Or there may be one unit with, say, 5 copies, and somewhere on another chromosome, a unit with 10 copies. But there are usually multiple copies of this. I've just drawn one, but maybe we'll put in 2, just to make that clear. So transcription occurs here, and you make ribosomal RNA. Now, ribosomal RNA has to meet proteins and assemble into a ribosomal subunit. So it has to meet, and each ribosomal subunit has 20 or 30 different proteins. So the ribosomal proteins have to come here and combine with the right proteins with the right RNA to make subunits. The general opinion is that there are no functional ribosomes making protein in the nucleus. Some people think there may be a few, but probably there aren't any. But the newly made subunits, both small and large, are right here in the nucleus. So where do they work to make protein? Where does protein synthesis take place? In the nucleus or the cytoplasm? In the cytoplasm. So we know that the subunits, which are quite large, have to go out through a pore. So they have to be transported out. Where did the ribosomal proteins come from? Where were they made? They had to be made in the cytoplasm. So, okay. So out here, we had messenger RNA, and we were making ribosomal protein. And then that ribosomal protein had to go in. And we're not talking about one protein, of course. We're talking of at least 50 different kinds, 50 different ones at least. How did we make ribosomal protein? What did we need? Well, ribosomes, of course. Perennial chicken and the egg problem, but we needed something else. We needed the messenger RNA. How did the messenger RNA get here? We must have made that in the nucleus, right? So we should enlarge our nucleus here. So somewhere else on the DNA, probably not on the same chromosome, are the genes for making the messages that, when translated, will make ribosomal protein. So to make this work, we have to get all of them outside. So the point of this is that to make ribosomes takes a great deal of transport. You have to transport messenger RNA out of the nucleus, ribosomal proteins into the nucleus, and completed subunits out of the nucleus. And each time you do transport, you have to have active transport through a pore. You have to have either the right signal to go in or the signal to go out. And you have to complex with the right middleman protein, et cetera, and split GTP and so on. So making enzymes, making ribosomal subunits is what my mother-in-law used to call a production. A big deal. Okay. Now, the nucleolus is visible during interphase. But what happens during mitosis? During mitosis, there is no transcription. So what happens is this DNA is no longer available to be transcribed. So what happens during transcription is that we stop making message. It's used up to make proteins, but we don't make any more. The proteins go into the nucleus. They meet the ribosomal RNA that's there, but we're not making any more. and we take whatever proteins and RNA we have, we make as many subunits as possible, and we clean them out. So the assembly line stops. All the materials that was on the assembly line finishes, and is shipped out to the cytoplasm. So the nucleolus disappears. The DNA is still there. But all the materials in progress to make a subunit, all the RNA and the protein, is finished up and shipped away. Now, the DNA that remains, though, the DNA that codes for the ribosomal RNA, is called the nucleolar organizing region. Because where will the nucleolus reform? It will reform wherever this DNA is when interphase happens again. Because wherever this DNA is, that's where we'll make ribosomal RNA, that's where we'll track the ribosomal proteins, and that's where we'll start putting subunits together. Now, a cell can have one or more nucleolar organizing regions. Because remember we said you could have many copies of the ribosomal RNA gene, say 5 here, and then 6 on another chromosome. And each of those would be what is called an NOR. Now, cells sometimes have one nucleolus, sometimes they have more. How could they have more? Each individual nucleolar organizing region could make its own mini nucleolus. Or all the nucleolar organizing regions can cluster together in the cell in one place and make one big nucleolus. It depends on the cell type. So let's just say it one more time. The nucleolar organizing region is just the part of the DNA that codes for ribosomal RNA. It's what people sometimes call ribosomal DNA, because it codes for the RNA, ribosomal RNA. So the NOR doesn't disappear during mitosis. You can't see it, of course, but it's still there. But the nucleolus comes apart. Now, I want to say next about polymerases, but first, are there any more questions about this nucleolus business?
So when you see the nucleolus, is that just the proteins that have come into the RNA?
When you see the nucleolus, what are you seeing? Well, you're seeing something that picks up stain, and it is presumably a mixture of ribosomal RNA, ribosomal proteins, subunits in various states of assembly. All of those things probably stain. It's possible that only the protein part does. Any other questions? Yeah.
So in anything other than interphase, those small subunit parts just leave the nucleus?
When you're going through mitosis or meiosis,
right,
what happens is you stop supplying new ribosomal RNA and new ribosomal proteins. So what happens is whatever's on the assembly line finishes and leaves for the cytoplasm, but no new stuff comes in. So this area clears out. Yeah?
Why is it all concentrated in one area, like this whole process?
Why is this whole process clustered in one area? Well, the real answer is that it is. But to put it another way, it makes sense for manufacturing purposes that you bring together all the parts of a single thing, which is the ribosomal subunit. That the ribosomal RNA has to meet the ribosomal protein somewhere.
So it just automatically all
concentrates? So does it automatically concentrate? This is the question of why does anything in the cell stick to anything else? And is it specifically directed towards some specific place? Or is it just that this has a nuclear localization signal, and once it gets in here, the only thing it sticks to is this part? And I don't know the answer to that. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about is what it takes to get transcription. If you have DNA, in order to transcribe it to make messenger RNA and get anything done, you need RNA polymerase. In a prokaryote, that's basically it. But in a eukaryote, first of all, there are actually three different enzymes. One, RNA polymerase, one, two, and three. There are so many different RNAs and different kinds that each of these is in charge of a different kind of RNA. That polymerase 1 makes mostly ribosomal RNA. Polymerase 2 makes messenger RNA. And polymerase 3 makes transfer RNA and some other small RNAs. We're going to be concentrating pretty much on how polymerase 2 works, because the way you make messenger RNA determines which proteins you make, which determines what a cell does. Not that the other two aren't interesting, but we'll leave them for molecular biology. Now, it's sort of typical of eukaryotic cells that they do something very similar to what prokaryotic cells do, but it's more complicated. And this is a classic example, and we haven't got to the end of it. In prokaryotes, not only is there only one RNA polymerase, but it basically binds to the DNA, and that's it. There may be a few other proteins involved, but it's not a production. In eukaryotes, transcription is very complicated and requires a very large number of proteins be present in order for RNA polymerase to bind and to get started. Eukaryotic RNA polymerase does not bind directly to DNA. Other proteins have to be there first, and then the RNA polymerase sits on top. All of the other proteins that you need to get transcription to work are usually called transcription factors. Or TFs. And you need a whole collection of separate TFs in order to get eukaryotic transcription to work. And these transcription factors have many subtle differences in what they do, and we'll talk about it in detail somewhat next time. But today I just want to divide them into two classes. One class are called basal or general transcription factors. These are the same in every cell and probably for every gene and every promoter. This is the basic equipment you need to bind to the DNA so the RNA polymerase will sit on top and you can get some transcription. But if you have them, you don't get very much transcription. In order to get a decent amount of transcription, you have to have additional factors, which are called regulatory transcription factors. As it turns out, there are those that help transcription, there are those that block transcription, there's all kinds of combinations. And it is probably the regulatory transcription factors who are in charge. The question is always, why does one cell make one set of proteins or read one set of genes? And why does another cell make different proteins and transcribe a different set of genes? What triggers the whole process? And we think it determines what regulatory transcription factors the cell has, determines what genes will be read, what proteins will be made. And that, of course, leads to the question of who turns on the transcription factors. And that is the big question of developmental biology, and Dr. Heitland will talk about that later in the term. But what we're going to talk about next time in some detail is how transcription factors, once you have them, turn on transcription. But for now, we're just trying to do a sort of survey of what's in that nucleus. So if this is a eukaryotic nucleus, it has three polymerases in here. And not surprisingly, RNA polymerase 1 is associated with the nucleolus, because that's where you make ribosomal RNA. And of course, there are a whole bunch of transcription factors in addition. Now, why do you need all these different enzymes and transcription factors to get a little transcription? What's the big deal? Why can't RNA polymerase just move up to the DNA, sit on the DNA, and get the show on the road? Why is it so complicated in eukaryotes? And the real, or at least part of the big answer to this, is that the DNA in eukaryotes is in a complex structure with proteins called chromatin. And it is necessary to alter the chromatin in some way so it can be read. and to alter it another way when you want to turn it off. So you don't just have plain old DNA, you have a complicated structure to deal with. And so what we have to do next is look at the structure of chromatin. What does the DNA in a eukaryotic cell, what state is it in? And then we'll see how you can regulate its transcription. So before I erase all this stuff, are there any more questions about any of this? If you isolate the chromosomes of eukaryotic cells, you find they contain both DNA, of course, and a lot of protein. And most of the protein associated with DNA is histones. Histones are a class of very small basic proteins. So what we're really saying is that chromosomes have both. So the genetic material of eukaryotes, the DNA, is always associated with proteins. It's virtually never just plain. And most of those proteins are histones. But there are also some non-histone proteins. This would include the transcription factors and some other stuff. And we're going to talk first about the histones today, and next time, a little bit more about the others. Now, how is the DNA and the histones all sort of stuck together? The first thing to be noticed was that people looked in the light microscope, and they noticed that the DNA and its associated protein seem to have two basic forms. And these are written on the top of 9A in that little table. And they're called heterochromatin and euchromatin. It's one word, but... Now, we're talking now about interface. Heterochromatin is very tightly wrapped up or condensed, and it stains very darkly. So it's darker stain, it's condensed or tight. If you look during mitosis or meiosis, everything is heterochromatin. Everything is all tight, and it's wrapped up into individual chromosomes. But when you look during interphase, most of the chromatin has loosened up and stretched out somewhat. And so that's called euchromatin. So this is this does not stain as darkly. And it's well, just to say, less condensed or looser. Now, in both of these cases, the DNA is associated with proteins. But the question is the DNA protein combination folded back on itself very tightly, or is it relatively loosely arranged? That's the difference. So what happens in mitosis is everything is tight. When it comes time to interphase, most of the DNA stretches out more, I should say the chromatin, which is why an interphase nucleus looks sort of like this. Because most of the chromatin is stretched out. But there are areas in here which remain tightly condensed. And those are called heterochromatin. They don't loosen up. They remain tight. Now, the significance of it is that heterochromatin is generally not transcribed. It's a state in which the DNA is not accessible to RNA polymerase. It's too tight. And that DNA, therefore, is genetically inactive. It's lying around and may be doing something important, but that is not being used to make RNA. Now, this DNA inside here, even though it's tight, can be replicated. Presumably, it loosens up enough temporarily for the DNA to be replicated. So it's copied and it's passed on, but it's not used as genetic information. On the other hand, euchromatin isn't necessarily transcribed, but we could say it's transcribable. It's loose enough. It's loose enough that it's possible for RNA polymerase to get in there and read it. But it isn't necessarily being read now. Now, before we leave heterochromatin, as shown on your chart, heterochromatin is subdivided into two categories, which are called constitutive, meaning all the time, and facultative, meaning sometimes. Constitutive heterochromatin is heterochromatin that in every cell and at all times is tightly folded. Doesn't matter where you look, which cell type, what time, it's always tight. And that usually consists of the stuff which is near the end of chromosomes, which are called telomeres, or in the middle of chromosomes, where the sister chromatids attach and they connect to the spindle fibers, which are the centromeres. So heterochromatin is very strong. Constitutive heterochromatin, let's put it the other way. Telomeric chromatin and centromeric chromatin is almost always constitutive heterochromatin. This is thought to mean because these parts really serve a more structural function than genetic information function. The telomeres are there to cap the chromosomes, and the centromeres are there to hold sister chromatids together and to allow proper separation at mitosis, etc., and exactly what sequence of bases they contain is not what's important. Now, what's facultative heterochromatin? That's chromatin that is tight and inaccessible in some cells at some times in interphase, but not in others. And the most famous example of it is the inactive X. We said last semester that in a female cell in a mammal, there are, of course, two X chromosomes, one from your mom and one from your dad. A male has only one X. But in a female, there are two. And one of these two is turned off in each cell type. So each individual cell at some early stage randomly turns off one or the other. And all the mitotic cells that come from that have the same X off. So only one works. One works, meaning that at interphase, one of these stretches out and becomes euchromatin pretty much, and the other one remains tight as heterochromatin, and that's the visible bar body. That is the heterochromatic form of the inactive X, which can actually be seen in interphase under some conditions. Now, why is this called facultative heterochromatin? Of these two X's, let's say they're mine, one is from my mom, one is from my dad, in some of my cells, this one is heterochromatic, forming a bar body, but in other cells, this one is heterochromatic, forming a bar body. So sometimes one, sometimes the other. And in early development, neither of them is heterochromatic. So this is an example of facultative heterochromatin. Now, what about euchromatin? Euchromatin is all looser than heterochromatin. Now, if you have a gene that's not being transcribed in interphase, It may be off, but it's probably euchromatin. Almost all genes are euchromatic in interphase, whether they're on or whether they're off. One of the problems is that all the euchromatin looks the same. So finding out which genes are a little tighter or a little looser, or on or off, turns out not to be straightforward. It's not easy to do. But in the euchromatin, we know that some of it is looser than others. It's all loose relative to heterochromatin. It probably is a continuum from loose to a little more, to a little more, to a little more, to very loose. But for convenience, we've subdivided it into three categories on your handout, on the little table, which I've called loose, looser, and loosest, for want of a better name. Now, let's say the looser or the intermediate category. This is the DNA or chromatin which is actually being transcribed, or it just was, or it's just about to be. This is open enough so that RNA polymerase and the transcription factors can get in, transcribe it, and use it. Loose DNA is not being transcribed right now, probably isn't going to be in the short run. So it's not being transcribed right now, but it's still relatively loose. What about loosest? This turns out to be mostly regulatory regions. Remember promoters? Some of the DNA codes for something, make a message, make a protein. But a lot of your DNA is involved in regulation. It's involved in controlling how much you read other genes. And those regions seem to be the loosest when the genes they control are on. So this is sort of the switch regions of the DNA, or the regulatory. And as we will see as we go, this is a little different in composition than all of the others. Almost all of this DNA, tight or loose, is folded up with histones. The only exception is the very loosest. Now remember, it's not naked DNA. It's folded up with proteins, but those proteins are not histones. In the very loosest case, the histones have been replaced by regulatory transcription factors. But we will explain all of this, again, from another angle as we go. But I just want to make it clear that on and off doesn't correspond to heterochromatin, euchromatin. Also, one more time, at least for all the categories of looser, loose, and heterochromatin, the difference is not the binding of histones, but how tightly the histone DNA combination is wrapped up. So I want to actually look at how are the histones and the DNA put together. So let me ask before I do that, are there any questions? Okay. Now, the first clue to what was going on came when people took chromatin and under certain conditions, including low salt, they saw that the chromatin had a kind of repeating structure, which is called beads on a string. It looks sort of like this. So this is, as far as we can tell, loose chromatin. Very loose, that would correspond actually probably to looser. This is relatively loose chromatin, and it looks like what we've got here is we have clusters of histones, and here the DNA and the histones are wrapped together, and then there's a sort of spacer, and then they're wrapped together, and there's a spacer, and so on. Now remember I said that you can't usually directly figure out what the state of a particular section is. You would like to know, for example, what state are the globin genes in? In this particular cell type, are the globin genes tight or are the globin genes loose? It's very hard to do. You generally have to do it indirectly. You have to do something to the chromatin and then see what happened to your globin genes. So here, you have to do something to your chromatin and see what happens to your DNA, except this is bulk DNA. What people discovered is a particular DNase, the one called micrococcal nuclease, digests this DNA in a particular pattern. Now, this was discovered by accident. This enzyme does not cut DNA at a particular sequence like a restriction enzyme. This enzyme cuts DNA where it is more exposed or sensitive in ways that are not fully understood. And if you treat chromatin with a little bit of this DNA, this enzyme, if you'd use a little bit, what you get is pieces of DNA which are multiples of 200. Now, notice what we're saying here is you don't treat the DNA with your enzyme. If you treat DNA with DNase, what do you think happens? Chomp, 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 garbage. We're treating chromatin instead. We're treating the DNA chromatin, DNA protein combination, because what's sticking out is going to get chewed and what's protected is not. So if you treat the chromatin now with a little bit of this nuclease and then you remove the protein and then you have the DNA left. And now you can examine that DNA, and people usually do that by running it on a gel. And you get what's called a ladder pattern that looks like this. Now, this is the smallest DNA and the largest on a gel. And it turns out that this is 200 base pairs, approximately. And the others are multiples of 200. So you get 200, 400, 600, 800, 1,000, 1,200. Now, what is the explanation of this? The explanation is that I probably should have written it like this. Here the DNA is associated with histones, and here the DNA sticks up. You have these linkers. But there's something about the structure of the linker that there's one point which is sensitive, more sensitive to the enzyme than any other point. So if you add a little bit of enzyme, either you cut here or you don't cut at all. Now, if you add a little bit of enzyme, you don't cut every single time. You cut on the average, let's say, every fourth. So you might cut a piece like this, and then when you take off the protein and stretch out the DNA, it's 200 base pairs long. But now you might cut here and here. And now if you take off the protein and cut, look at the DNA, it's 400 long. So you can get multiples of 200. So that gives you this pattern. Now, what if you use a lot of DNA, a lot of nuclease? If you use a lot of micrococcal nuclease, you essentially chew off the entire linker. So what you do again is you treat chromatin, remember, then you remove the protein, and you get the DNA. And now if you run the DNA on a gel, you get just one band. And this is about 145 base pairs. One book says 146, one says 147, somewhere around 145. So what that tells you is that in here, in this bead thing, the histones are wrapped up with about 145 base pairs. but it's 200 from here to here. So that means that this part is the remainder, that this is about 55. The linker is about 55. So what people did was to say, what is the protein that I took off? What is the protein? And now we'll ask, how are the protein and the DNA put together? So if you isolate the protein here, the protein is these histones. And the histones consist of one kind, which is called H1, and another's, which are called H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. The reason I've separated them is because these are found in the core of the bead. And this one, H1, appears to be sort of on top. If you degrade the DNA with micrococcal nuclease, the H1 falls off. So the H1 is here somewhere. But the others are in here, making up the bead. And we know from the proportions that per 200 base pairs of DNA, there's one H1 and two each of H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. Now, there are four of these, two of each. So the combination of two of each is called an octamer, because it has eight molecules of histone in it. Now we know that if you have the eight molecules of histones, that they protect about 145 base pairs of DNA. So how do you think the histones and the DNA are arranged? The histones should be on the outside, right? Wrong. The histones, believe it or not, are on the inside. And how this looks is shown on your handout. And I meant to bring a model for this, but I forgot. But you have your, if you look on 9A on the bottom right, what you have there is one histone octamer on the top. So let's see what this represents. The eight histones come together, and I'll draw it like this given the time of the year. And the idea is now the DNA is wrapped around it. So if you look at the double-stranded DNA there, it looks like this, and then it goes behind and you can't see it. And then it goes again, and it goes behind and you can't see it. And then they've put the H1 over here. So this is the H1, and this is the octamer. Apparently, the DNA is wrapped so tightly around the octamer that the enzyme can't get underneath and chew it up. That if you think of the DNA as being plastered tightly on top, even though the protein is underneath, the protein prevents the enzyme, protects the DNA from being digested by the enzyme. So when you add just a little bit of nuclease, you cut, say, here, because this sticks out more. When you add a lot of nuclease, then you cut all of the stuff between here and the next rep. Now, underneath, they show you how it looks if you have a chain. That you have a bunch of these together. And as we will see, what happens is, if you think about how is the DNA, the DNA is originally like this, and then the DNA is wrapped around these octamers, and then the chain of octamers is further coiled into the next picture, and then though that chain is wiggled into the final one. And that's shown in more detail on the other side of your handout. Thank you. So this picture sort of shows you how you wrap up the DNA and what happens. Now, to compare to this, if you want it later, there is a table in your handout, I mean in your notes, which looks at this in a slightly different way. As you fold the DNA and the nucleosomes, oh, I didn't use that term. So this whole thing is called one nucleosome. And it includes 200 base pairs of DNA, one H1, and 8 of the other histones. As you wrap the DNA around the nucleosomes, and then the nucleosomes around each other, the fiber that you have gets shorter and shorter and thicker and thicker. And that's what's diagrammed here and summarized in the table. So you start with DNA, which is about 2 nanometers across. And then you wrap it around histones. Now, what they are showing here, what you're looking at here is from one side. But what if you were looking this way? There'd be a bead here, and you'd be wrapping around the sides of it. So that's why in the picture on the other, now where it says 11 nanometers, it looks like this. The histone from the heart is this way. Okay. And this is wider, it's 10 to 11 nanometers wider, but it's also shorter. And people say it's about one, this is about 1/7 the length of the original DNA. The same amount of DNA wrapped around the appropriate number of nucleosomes is 1/7 the length. So people say that's a packing ratio of 7. Then you take the nucleosomes and you stack them together in a kind of spiral braid. It's not clear whether it's a spiral or a zigzag, but that's the next one. This is the 30 nanometer fiber. And when you do that, you get 1/6 shorter than it was before, so the overall packing ratio is 42. So we're 1/42 the length of the original DNA, and a lot thicker. Now, the beads on the string stage looks like this. We think the DNA that's actually being transcribed, or just been or about to be, is probably at this stage. Tighter layers are probably not being transcribed right now, but we're still talking euchromatin. So then, this is formed into loops, as shown in your handout, so that it looks sort of like this. And there's a sort of protein scaffold down here. So this would be made of 30 nanometer fiber, but the whole thing is about 300 nanometers wide. So now we're down to 1/75 of the original length, or a packing ratio of 750. Now people think perhaps that this is the way the DNA is organized in your chromosomes, and that you pull out one loop at a time to the beads on a string stage if you want to do transcription. Now I have to leave this door open for her so when she brings the exams we can get them. Okay. Now it keeps going and you take, now you have this 300 nanometer fiber and you fold it up further and further. And much further than, when the point of this is that when you fold it up enough times, you can end up with heterochromatic mitotic chromosomes. And there's something like, you've condensed it by an enormous factor, something like 15 to 20,000 fold shorter than it was to begin with. Now, You need to be able to pack the DNA very tight in order to carry out mitosis and distribute the chromosomes around without them getting all tangled up. You have to be able to loosen it up in order to be able to replicate or transcribe. Now, this picture here on the right shows not just the packing levels, but a little bit more of one of the critical things about histones. If you look at your histones in the picture on the picture on the bottom shows you the one view, sort of this view. And the picture on the top, the big picture, corresponds to the heart on the other side. And the thing that's really critical here is that when you look at your heart, you don't have to turn it over, but if you look at the bigger picture, you see that the histone, most of the histones are packed into a solid structure, but some of the peptide chains stick out, and these are called tails. It turns out that these tails can be modified, that chemical groupings can be added and removed to these tails. And that apparently affects the looseness and the tightness at higher levels of structure. So to get this far, you don't need H1 at all. To get further, you do need H1. Certain modifications correspond to tighter wrapped up. Some of them correspond to looser. And the question that has always interested people is, how does the looseness and the tightness correspond to genetic activity, whether it's being transcribed or not, and what is the causal instrument? Do the modifications cause transcription? Do the transcriptions cause modification? Or do the transcription factors trigger all of it? And that's what we're going to talk about next time. So we'll finish everything in this section that we didn't do, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the fine points of transcription. Now, if there are any TAs here, we'd appreciate it if you come up and help. We have all the exams. Everybody, this is Naya, who takes care of all the dirty work for this class, without which we could not function. We have all the exams. We will give out C, the morning section ones first, and then if you want to stay, the others. Alternatively, you can come during those times and pick up your exam, or after class tonight, or they will be in the boxes after 11 tomorrow. Great. So Bart has N to Z. He's going to go over there. Okay. You're right.